Hi folks, I've got a quick disclaimer here for you. The day after this episode came out, a story went up on The Daily Beast in which porn actress Kelly Shibari accuses Reid Mahalko, our guest in this episode, of coercing her into a sexual encounter 8 years ago. This is obviously really upsetting, given Reid's public emphasis on consent. He offers a number of explanations in the article, but none of them is an apology, which is disheartening. We've decided to leave this episode up because we believe we owe you transparency and context, and because we think the content of this interview still has some value, but we wanted to add this little note off the top so you can decide not to listen to this episode if you think it would be triggering or otherwise troubling for you. We'll talk more about this next week. Thanks for listening and for taking care of yourself. Welcome to The Dildork, storky discourse on sex, dating, and masturbating. My name is Kate Sloan. I'm a sex journalist, a sex blogger, and a sex geek. Who are you, friend?
I'm Bex. I'm a sex educator, a sex blogger, and I think I own 3 sex geek t-shirts, which is just excessive, really.
So you know you're a real sex geek. That's probably too many of those to own.
Yeah.
We are joined today by the originator of the Sex Geek t-shirts, among many other things that he does. One of my very favorite people in the sex education sphere, Reid Mahalko. Hi, Reid.
So just do like your little Twitter length bio, who you are, what you do, why you're awesome.
Well, I go by many names, and I've been called America's favorite sex geek. Somebody once, I think L. Chase called me the Tom Hanks of sex education, which I don't know what that means other than... sometimes, you know, when I'm fucking people, I want to smack their butt consensually and just scream out, Wilson! And not everybody gets that reference, but I do a lot of different things, and sex education and also helping sex educators get better around the business things, because I'm one of those privileged individuals who actually gets to do this 24/7 and make a living, which is, you know, a lot harder than you think, because we imagine that people will pay all kinds of money for sex and sex advice. And that's true and also not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you run kind of the line in this industry because sex sells. But at the same time, everyone's like, I know how to do that. No one needs to tell me about sex. I'm great. And you're like, right.
Yeah, it's tricky. And it's also tricky, too, because there's so much shame and fear. And, yeah. And fear and uncertainty keeps, like, if you start nerding out on, like, sales and the psychology of buying, and then just the ideas around how people try to solve their own problems and what stops them from that, then when we as sex nerds and dildorks and geeks, we're like talking about anal lube and what's your preference of anal lube, like at Thanksgiving, to the chagrin of our families. And, you know, for a lot of other people, like, they're just not that shame literate yet. Mm-hmm. And they don't have a lot of the emotional tools that we as professional sex geeks or amateurs, a lot of us are way more emotionally literate than the general population. And so while people are interested in empowering themselves, they get shut down internally, and then also judged by their partners or their communities for wanting to go to a blowjob workshop or wanting to buy a vibrator or something like that. So it's really interesting when you start like looking at what holds us back. And at the same time, like, I've got 6 fingers pointing back at me. It's not, you know, like my area might be around sex where I feel empowered, but around finances and money, like, I had to do a lot of work to unravel and untangle all the bullshit bad role modeling I got from my mom and dad, and they were just doing the best that they could. Mm-hmm. And so it's very interesting, like, when you start kind of going down these rabbit holes. And at the same time, like, this is where I can acknowledge you two for just doing what you do and being who you be and creating ways for people to passively and actively listen and, you know, put ideas and words into their ear holes, and then also realize, like, holy shit, like, you have an entire podcast about masturbation and other stuff. And, like, you know, the authorities haven't come and dragged you away, or lightning hasn't come through your roof and struck you down. Yeah, not yet. And these are, this is what it, why it is so powerful. Like, just starting to help people wrap their minds around, they can talk about this stuff or even think about it, and they're not a bad person. That's really powerful.
Yeah, I recently had, so like you were saying, with the sex stuff, I've had some stuff that I've struggled with shame around or whatever, but it hasn't been like a huge thing, because this is where I nerd out. This is the thing I unpack all the time, you know? But like, I didn't start drinking or smoking weed or any of that stuff until I was way older, until I was like 23, 24. So like, that whole thing for me was all of this like shame unpacking, and I'm like, oh, culturally says it's bad, but like, is it bad? How do I really feel about it? And like, a little bit into that, I was like, oh, this is all the shame stuff that people go through with like the sex stuff. This is like the same process. That, and it was like fascinating to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's from, I grew up in a family where my mom was an alcoholic and my dad tried to help the family dynamic by making more money. So yeah, because he just wanted my mom not to be angry and to not be drunk all the time. So he became a workaholic, and they just had such crappy communication skill sets, even though it was so evident to me and my brothers how much they loved each other, and they just weren't going to give up on that love, but they slowly destroyed each other. And that, you know, all that shame of not talking about stuff, and then also not having the communication skill sets to talk about those things. Yeah, like my brother, or my a year younger than me, my brother Ryan, and I, like, Ryan was like the biggest thing in New Hampshire football ever, still to this day. And we were like the all-American, you know, family. And, you know, there's like maybe five people at our high school, our football coach and our principal and a couple other people, who knew that my mom was a drunk, and that we wouldn't know if she was coming to pick us up after school because she might be passed out. Like, there was all this silence. You know, and then we, as some of us, you know, we're like, we become shame nerds, and then we're like, oh, like, I just want to, like, I'm going to feel my shame and fuck myself with the dildo. And then, like,
yeah, that's, you have that moment of, you're like, oh my God, this feels awful. Oh, it's fascinating though. Where did that come from?
Yeah.
Like, you get really meta all of a sudden, and you're like, I feel terrible, but why?
Yeah. And then you start pairing like pleasure with feeling terrible. In a very conscious way, right? Because you can also kind of anchor it in weird, warped ways. But like, it becomes an act of agency. But most people don't have the tools to start deconstructing the reality of the situation and all the bullshit cultural advice that holds us back. Most people can't like start tearing that apart to then reassemble it as an act of reclamation and be like, no, like, I feel, and this is, I'll talk me personally.
Yeah.
I feel like my sexuality will hurt people. Like my greatest fear is that, like, somehow just me being a slut is gonna destroy folks. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's not rational. And then my job is to always kind of be tracking it, like I'm some sort of shame, this week on Shame Trackers, you know? And then it's like, ooh, like, I have this fantasy that has a lot of shame around it. And I grew up in a family where you never talked about stuff. So what if I talked about it with my loved ones? And, you know, lo and behold, all these years later, my birthday party is my shame party. Like, my friends come together. We have a play party. And they come together specifically for me to ask for something I think they cannot love me for. Around amazing. Sex. And then what they're
so
like.
Good.
They're like, what? You want to just line us up on us on our, you know, in a row and just fuck us indiscriminately one at a time? And I'm like, yes, is that okay? And they're like, that, Reed, you know, yes, we will do this for you, but we think we can do this one better. How about while you fuck us indiscriminately and just put your dick in one hole after another as you go down the row? How about the ones of us who don't want to be penetrated? How about we just whisper into your ears how much we love you and how much you deserve this? And I'm like, that's gonna make me cry. And they're like,
yep.
We want to see if you can keep a hard on while you cry. And I'm like, okay. You know, but again, like, that's not everybody's jam, right?
Yeah. Well, all I'm thinking is all of the stories you've told about being like, you know, those times I went to kink camp and I'm not really kinky or whatever. And then it's like, I want to see if you can be hard while weeping. Is that, can we do that? And I'm like, that's a little bit of a kink thing.
But for me, it's not kinky. Like, it's, yeah, I'm just like, it's, I just like want to be loved. Is that all right? So, I mean,
yeah, well, you're also talking to me who's like, feelings. Wow, that's edgy. I don't know.
It so
that's,
edgy.
That's where my shame stuff is. I'm like, I don't have feelings. We don't.
Again, like, it's about like what makes us healthier, right?
Yeah.
And it's not about being perfect. It's about progress. And mastery isn't about perfection. It's about turnaround time. It's like, how quickly do you realize that you've shut down and aren't speaking up about the things you want for whatever reason? You don't think you deserve them. You don't think your partners can handle your true desires. Like, and then slowly you can walk yourself out of that forest and be like, oh, wait a minute. If I'm surrounded, you know, I'm disempowering my partner by thinking they can't handle my desire. Or, which is really, I think my partner can handle a conversation about my desire. Because just because you spoke about something doesn't mean you're agreeing to, on Tuesday, we have to do it. But those are, that's how our fear brain works, you know, is, oh my God, if I let you talk to me about the threesomes, I've now opened up the Pandora's box of threesomes. And that means Tuesday I'm in bed with a stranger who you're going to like more. And I'm going to have feelings of jealousy. And it's like, whoa, like, slow the roll down, everyone. Like, we're just having a conversation about fantasies and desires. And then there's all these other conversations about if it's even a good idea.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, assume that it's like, okay, if I bring this up, the answer is either do it or break up forever. And it's like, there's middle ground there.
Absolutely. But most people don't have that nuance, right? It's the world is very binary. It's very black and white around desires. And we either have to, or somehow I'm not evolved because I'm not into having a threesome. Like, there's all this overachievingness. You know, that's seeped into the bedroom. That's fucking people up. Like, I would just like to reclaim mediocre sex again. Like, how was that? Yeah. Yay, we won. You know, like, how about that? Yeah. How about, like, not every sexual encounter has to end with somebody squirting so hard that you knocked over the lamp or something like that. Like, how about we just, like, how about just cuddle sex? And, you know, and like a meh orgasm, like, hey, you know, but we can't go there.
We did the thing, now we sleep.
Exactly. Because we're somehow broken because we're not having transformational, you know, sex every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, I went to the gym today. I'm tired. I don't have energy for transformational sex. I need more pre-workout for that.
Exactly. Right. But then there's like all these crayons in the crayon box of what connection is. It doesn't, like, because then we think it has to be sexual. Like, people misunderstand me, and they're because I'm such a slut, but they're like, well, if I don't feel like fucking you, Reed, we can't hang out. And I'm like, where the fuck is that written? Like, who said that? That'd be like if you were a musician. Do either of you play music?
Yes,
Kate does.
Okay. I'm musically declined. Like, I'm so unevolved around music. But again, like, if I was a musician, like, yes, you know, I love to play music. But do you think you can't hang out with your music friends unless you're playing music? Right?
But if friendship was based on that, Kate and I would never be friends because I can't.
But it's like, you're not like, oh, you know, shit, I can't hang out with Kate unless I bring my guitar.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But again, like, but then, you know, there's weird, you know, things that we apply to sluts and folks who are promiscuous. And so again, like, it's back to like talking about these things. And then your friends ideally are people who also have good communication skills who will, you know, at some point come around and notice they didn't say something and come clean about it. And, you know, and this is where it just gets tricky, but yeah, I don't know how we got onto the everyone has to sleep with me thing. I don't know.
Well, so you mentioned good communication skills, and that's something that I really admire about your approach to flirting, which is like one of my favorite things that you teach about, because a lot of the things that you teach about flirting
I've like never heard before and like make a lot of sense to me. I feel like so much education stuff about flirting is just like, be good at it, be charming. And I'm like, okay, but I don't feel charming. I don't know like how to take the steps to like become charming. Can you give us like what is like your general approach to flirting? What is like your flirt philosophy?
Yeah. So I call it speed flirting.
Okay.
But there's a reason for all of this. Like people look at me. And I mean, and again, like, you know, I wasn't always this way. I was a comic book artist, went to art school. I was an athlete in high school and in college for a little bit, and a martial artist for a long time. And if you actually get to know me, like, dude, like, your entire psychological makeup is just Marvel Comics from the 70s. And I'm like, with great power comes great responsibility. You know, and then in today's day and world, it's like, with great privilege comes great responsibility. You know, so... You know, and you know, my non-toxic cis white guy ethic is basically just Captain America, and Daredevil, who's a little bit fucked up, but okay, and then Ghost Rider, you know, Johnny Blaze, who sold his soul to save, you know, someone that he loved and was tricked, you know, so this is like, you're like, wow, he's pretty simple, he's just a comic book nerd, and I'm very insecure because of my alcoholic upbringing and the things that my mom would say to me when she was drunk. And I've done a lot of self-work on all that stuff. And I know that my mom and dad really were doing the best that they could. And their marriage rocked early on. Like my brothers and I would catch them making out in the kitchen all the time and cuddling on the couch. And then things just got worse over time because it was all these little things they couldn't talk about. And when they tried to talk about them, things would end emotionally violently, not physically violently, in my family. But it, you know, it was kind of like death by paper cuts, like all this emotional scarring over time to their marriage. And so the things that my mom would say to me when she was drunk, and then the lies that my father would tell the family later about things, like really kind of fucked me up. Even though my mom and dad got the basic programming in early, with decent, healthy attachment parenting and stuff like that, even though they wouldn't have called it back then. And then my mom had this feminist conversation with me when she caught me making out with a Playboy centerfold, not an actual woman who was a centerfold, but the actual centerfold. And she turned me into a feminist and didn't know it. And I don't know that she would have used feminism as something she identified with. But like they were pretty rad people, but I grew up to be quite insecure and nerdy, anxious, and was the pudgy fifth grader who had the brilliant idea of nicknaming myself Captain Twinkie. This is actually true. This is not made up. I drew a logo of a Twinkie with a lightning bolt through it. I named myself Captain Twinkie because I loved Twinkies back then. And then the coup de grace that would ruin my eighth grade dance experiences is that I would only answer to the name Captain Twinkie in fifth grade. So you can imagine how what this wreaked havoc on me in my seventh and eighth grade life. And again, I was also a Connect Four nerd. So like I just wanted to play Connect Four. Like that's how I flirted, was like, hey, would you like to play Connect Four? And then I would just kick your ass in Connect Four because I couldn't not be like, ah, it was so bad, so bad. So no wonder nobody wanted to go to the eighth grade prom with me. And all this is to say that most of my communication stuff and emotional self-awareness stuff, a lot of the stuff I had to create either because I didn't find better tools early on, but like the Safer Sex Elevator speech, which people can check out at it's readaboutsex.com/elevator, the difficult conversation formula, which is at readaboutsex.com/convo, like all of this stuff, the awkward formula, the embrace the awkward formula, like all these things were me engineering a way through my own insecurity. And then what has happened over time is that I'm still very insecure. I'm just really secure about how insecure I am. And then I have all these approaches to just kind of work through it. So speed flirting is based on the idea that I have a 15 to 30 seconds to come talk to you before I dump enough cortisol and adrenaline into my blood system, because I know when I like somebody. And if I don't come talk to you immediately, I will then work myself up into a nerdy, insecure frenzy where I will spend the next 40 minutes just looking at you from across the room while I wait for my blood chemistry to calm down enough for me to come talk to you then. So the problem is, if it takes me 20 to 40 minutes of like creeping around the side of the room, you know, secretly looking at you, by the time I come up to you 20 minutes later, 30 minutes later, you're like, because you've noticed me, you know, like I'm a 6 foot tall white guy who, like, you know, is basically a golden retriever on espresso. Like, I'm hard to miss. And like, by the time I come up to talk to you, like, you're going to just run in the other direction. So when you reverse engineer all this, it's shit, I've got 20 seconds to come talk to you. How do I do this? And then when I run it through my back computer of like, how do I do this? Now that I have a lot more examined, you know, male privilege, which was not the case 10 years ago. And now that we're in the, you know, the Me Too world, and we've always been in that. It's just that people, it wasn't safe for people to come forward. Like I worry about shit that I did, just being the anxious, you know, overly enthusiastic 230-pound golden retriever on espresso hang out with a bunch of feminists who were so excited to be hanging out in queer spaces and feminist spaces that I would just bound up to people and be like, hi, I'm a slut, what are you? And again, now all these years later, it's like, no, like, I've realized why certain kinds of hitting on people is just a bad idea. Like, because I have more court awareness. Like, I understand dynamics I didn't understand before. I've examined and reflected a lot of things. So now, again, when you run that all through the back computer, how you flirt with people is you walk up to them and you say, excuse me, I would like to flirt with you. May I have a conversation with you about whether or not that's a good idea? Yes or no? And then people are like, excuse me? And you're like... my name is Reed. I would like to flirt with you, but I don't know if that's a good idea. Can we have a conversation for a minute to find out if that would be acceptable to you? And then people are like, because they're just not used to that coming from anybody's mouth. And then they're like, I'm sorry, what? And I'm like, hi, my name is Reed. I would like to flirt with you. I'd like to have a conversation about flirting with you before I begin to flirt. Would you like to have that conversation, yes or no? And then sometimes people will be like, no. And I'm like, thank you for taking care of yourself. And then I start walking away. And again, like, you don't use this, you can't use this as a strategy. Like, you actually have to try to be genuine and transparent. Because this isn't like some sort of like, you know, pickup artist game. But like, when you say thank you for taking care of yourself and you walk away again, you know, as you start to go down the rabbit hole of sexism and rape culture and male privilege, you realize that most female identified or presenting folk, and also a lot of other, you know, queer folk too, because this is so weird in the gay men's community, which I don't spend a lot of time in, but as a queer slut who sleeps with a lot of, I just like genitals. I don't know. I don't care what you call them. Just tell me what I can touch and what I can't touch, and what not to say. And like, if you're, you know, if we have a conversation, it seems like a good idea. Like, I like people. I like bodies. And you know, like, a lot of women and queer folk do not ever get anyone saying thank you when they say no and just walking away because of the way that we were. You know, the way that gender is taught and the way that we're acculturated, like, I'm supposed to somehow convince you to say yes or wear you down or all this other bullshit stuff. So what ends up happening is when you say thank you for taking care of yourself and you just walk away, every once in a while, somebody be like, stop. What'd you just do? Like, I believe I just respected your boundaries and now I'm walking away. And they're like, come back here. I'm like, okay. And they're like, all right, maybe I want to flirt. I'm like, okay. But you just said no. are you changing your mind? And they're like, yes. And I'm like, okay. You know, and so, like, it feels really clunky and awkward, but it is really about embracing the awkward. And the thing that most people don't talk about, because you never even get to this place, is when I'm using that kind of direct negotiation and trying to, you know, get a yes or a no and get buy-in, so I'm not flirtatiously spamming you, right? Like, I want you to opt into this. I'm also assessing whether or not you have your words.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole assessment protocol that's happening behind this to just find out if it's safe. Because for me as a slutty white guy, who's now like in the sex ed community, like I'm air quoting now, like I'm famous. Now there's all these power dynamics that are at play. And if I can't, you know, if I'm just meeting you, I need to figure out as, you know, smoothly and conscientiously and as appropriately, like whether this is a good idea or not. And mm-hmm. that's another tricky thing, right? Because as you start to bring in power dynamics and start trying to deconstruct these things, you know, you start to realize that most people, like I know a lot of sex educators who aren't great at speaking up all the time immediately. And the reason I know that is I'm one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, how do you do things appropriately? How do you do things, you know, with some consent savvy? And then how do you assess whether a situation is a good situation or not?
And I love the thing you talk about there, but you talk about it in a lot of your communication stuff, is just that meta communication is just mm-hmm. literally talking about how you're going to talk to them. And you talk about also like just calling out the awkward and being like, well, that was weird. Like people get so much more relaxed when you do that. Like, the number of times where I've come over to people and be like, well, you know, I was here because I like your face and I wanted to flirt with you, but now I'm just awkwardly rambling, so we're going to go with it and hope I can save this. And, like, just saying that out loud,
yeah.
you can feel them just go, oh, okay, I wasn't the only one that felt awkward. Like, we all know this is weird. It's fine. Let's just go with it. Yeah.
Here's my question. And again, like, I'm like, oh man, another white guy interrupting people. Damn it. I did it again. But like, so here's my question. Like, from your experiences, when is me being, or not just me, but like anyone, right? But we can use me as the example. When is me being transparent too forward and then slides over into harassment?
For me, like, what I like about what you said is that you said, like, I think I would like to flirt with you. Can we talk and see if that's a good idea? Because I've had people come up to me and be like, can I flirt with you? And I'm like, well, I don't know. Who are you? Like, I mean, you can for a minute and we'll see where it goes. But also, something I like is being like, is when people put kind of a time limit on stuff. Like, hey, I got 5 minutes. Can I flirt with you for a little bit? Because, like, ooh, for the next 5 minutes? Yeah, totally. But when I've also had people come up to me and be like, can I flirt with you? And I'll be like, yeah. And then they flirt with me every day for the next, like, 3 weeks. And I'm like, you could flirt with me then. But, like, yeah. If I know how much of a commitment I'm putting in, even if I'm at a party and someone is like, you know, hey, I'd like to talk to you. Like, I can talk to you for a little bit, but maybe I don't want to spend the whole party with you. So, like, just recognizing that there's a container that this interaction will exist in, and we can discuss what the interaction will look like beyond that container mm-hmm. at the end of that is really helpful. Cause I get really overwhelmed where I'm just like, oh God, I just met you, but am I supposed to be your best friend now? I don't know if I can handle that kind of commitment. Are we getting married? Like, I will definitely jump to like, oh, this is everything forever now.
It's the curse of being hyper aware. And I think folks who mm-hmm. grow up in, you know, wobbly families. Not that it's always about that. Like, I think intelligent people, like, you just have so much RAM. It's just going to process. It's just going to run some program, whatever's lying around. And you just notice everything. And for those of us who grew up in families where you're trying to, you know, do your best to not upset, you know, the parental figures around you as a survival technique, like, you just become fucking hyper aware of everything. And then when things are more safe, air quotes, your hyper awareness, you know, it feeds in, it just turns inward, and then you're just noticing everything going on in your brain. And now we're going to bring that into, I'm going to flirt with you, and I think I really like you. Kate, what about you? When is somebody being too transparent or too forward? Like, how does that occur to you?
I was agreeing with what Beck said about people coming up to me and wanting to flirt with me before saying anything to me, because I always feel like I don't know anything about you. Like, you are making a judgment about me based on how I look and have decided based on that you want to flirt with me. And that to me is always kind of weird, because I'm like, what if we hate each other? What if our politics don't align? What if our senses of humor don't match up? So I'm like, I would rather someone kind of talk to me for a few minutes before that, which is like part of how I've like adapted what I've learned from you about flirting, is I will just like drop the word flirt at some point in our conversation, almost like to label what's going on, to try to get us on the same page about what we're doing. So like, if I have to go to the bathroom or something, I might be like, hey, I'm going to go, like, I got to go, but like, I'll come back and flirt with you more later. Or I might be like, wow, you're like really good at flirting, or like, you know, I'll just like try to slot it in there, because I think it's a good way to like test, like gauge whether we're on the same page about that.
Yeah. The thing that happens to me is I'll start getting into my head. I'm like, oh God, are we flirting? I don't know what's happening. Do they like me? And then I'll start spinning out in my head, like not, mm-hmm. you know, with my friends who actually, you know, talk about and teach about anxiety. Like, I don't have anything that approaches that level. But it's like anxiety, like in all little caps, but I'll start to get worked up and worried. And then, you know, I'm just always trying to figure out, like, is there a better way to be more mindful and more conscientious? And then what are the social dynamics that are invisible to me because of privilege mm-hmm. that, you know, I can learn about so that I can just be better at this? And what seems to be, you know, working so far is like me just letting people know, like, hey, so, you know, this is awkward for me to say this, and I will totally just walk away. Just give me the nod. but you're sparkly in some way that is attracting me to come over to you, and I want to have a conversation with you and not appear to be creepy, and I want to mm-hmm. be playful and have it not be weird. And I kind of call that being flirty, but I don't know you yet. Where did I lose you, or should I continue? You know? And again, like, I think what's important for me, because I do get a lot of pushback on this. People are like, Reed, this isn't organic. You know, post-it note on body language. I want your opinions on body language. But it's like, they're like, this isn't organic. This is torturous. This is social suicide. And I'm like, no. No, because if you want me to go away, if I blew it by being transparent and kind of naming my agenda in the first place, which I think is kind of one of the quick, doesn't completely erase creepiness, because you can be creepy and be transparent, but it is a kind of one of the things that a lot of people are really well calibrated for, is to sniff out hidden agenda. Mm-hmm. And then if you just tell people what your agenda is, you know, and there's a little bit of relatedness and the context is right, it seems to be less creepy. And again, like, I can't, for me, having all the social interactions that I have every year, some of them sexual, mm-hmm. some of them not, and for all the years I've been like this, I can imagine that there are people who haven't felt comfortable coming forward to tell me that I was creepy or weird or something. Mm-hmm. And then, as you know, hopefully people will feel safe and come to me or use side channels to bring me information or do it anonymously, but then I will do my best to do my due diligence to help restore whatever thing I can restore, right? Because again, the other mm-hmm. thing is, people in this day and age right now, with the conversations that we're all wading through, you know what? Sometimes things happened and that person doesn't want your fucking help. They completed it for themselves, you know? And so like, when I'm coaching men now, there are a lot of guys who are like, well, I think I might have been shitty to this person in college or when I was a teenager. Like, should I call them up? I'm like, I don't know the best advice, because maybe they don't fucking want to hear from you, dude.
Yeah.
Like,
maybe don't bring that up for them.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, I'm still talking and geeking out with a lot of people trying to figure out, like, you know, what's the best overall advice mm-hmm. for handling these situations for cis guys right now who are well-meaning but don't know what the fuck to do. And the odds are when you don't know what to do, you will probably do the wrong thing, you know. But in a time where men need to be talking to men about this, like, I still think that these conversations are new for a lot of us. Mm-hmm. And seeking out tools and protocols from transformational justice and restorative justice and other areas, like, this is the beginning of that, right? And the emotional labor shouldn't be on women or, you know, anybody to help us, right? Why was I saying that? Goodness, I feel like I went on a tangent. But again, like, it's like it's this idea of, like, how do you make it safe for people to say no to you when you ask them nicely, would you like to flirt with me?
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody's going to be safe enough to speak up because they had some shitty reactions from men or just people in general, right? Because aggressive behavior, just because I think I'm being kind and transparent doesn't mean it's not landing on the other person as aggressive.
Yeah.
You know, or too forward, right? And so, you know, intent does not trump impact.
Yeah.
And then
you
start to, you know, as you start to realize this and can navigate it, and there's a little bit of relatedness, like, you, we kind of know each other or we've connected somehow. And then there's the context is right. So for me to ask, like, if we all ran into each other at a play party, me coming up to people and being like, hi, so there's this thing I want to ask you for. It feels nervous. I don't want it to be creepy. And, you know, I've listened to your podcast, all of them, and I'm a little bit of a star fucker and a fangirl. And I was wondering if I was going to hit on you or ask you to do something to my genitals, what would be the nicest way for me to do that? Could you help me, please? You know, like some, but saying the exact same thing at the checkout line to the checkout person, mm-hmm. or to the person running on the treadmill next to you, not cool.
Yeah. I think context is really important. And one of the things I love about your difficult conversation formula, which is kind of what you were modeling there and I send people to all the time, is that the way you kind of talk about, like, listen, I want to do this thing. This is what I'm nervous about. But, like, this is how I would like to see this go. And I think it's that great, it's transparency, and it tells the person what to expect out of that conversation without putting a lot on them. So I think the thing that worries me, my cat is just scratching my mattress. I don't know why. The thing that gets to me sometimes when people come up to me and, like, just will cold be like, hey, do you want to flirt? Is that, like, I don't know what that necessarily always means for them. Like, what does that container look like? So the thing with the difficult conversation formula, it kind of gives me, like, this is where you're, what you're afraid of. This is where I probably shouldn't go, but this is where you'd like to see it go. And these are, like, my options. And I think it lays out a lot and gives you, like, a playground to kind of exist within, which I really like.
So I just need the, you two will appreciate this and maybe the listeners, like, I'm making Venn diagrams right now based on this conversation. Because I'm like, ooh, maybe that's a way to teach this thing that I've been trying to wrestle with. And, I mean, another way to think of it too, like with meta communication, right? Because, and I think it might have been, Kate, I think it might have been you who used meta communication first with me, like as a phrase. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, oh, yeah, that's what it is. Like, because I use the word meta all the time, but I've never thought of it as, oh, there's meta communication. So talking about what we're talking about, which is a kind of transparency, but can also be confusing to people, right? Because not everybody is nerdy enough to be able to talk about the thing we're talking about while we're talking about it. Like, that can be a little bit too much. And then you just throw in social anxiety and, like, you know, dude, I don't know you, like all that stuff can make it a little bit more complex. But the idea of just being like, hey, I have a question for you. Do you have bandwidth for a question, right? Like, always try to get the opt-in so you're not spamming people emotionally. But it's like, how would you define flirting?
Oh, that's so good. I love that.
Because then you're coming with a question that doesn't... Now, again, like, this is where it can be, like, for me as a nuance nerd, it's like, I'm coming to you and I'm opening up a conversation about flirting because I want to flirt with you.
Yeah.
So is that okay that I hid my agenda? Like, mm-hmm. when can I reveal? Like, it's kind of like the social version of you get in on the second floor of the elevator and we're both riding up to the 15th floor.
Yeah.
And I tell you at the 12th floor that you have toilet paper sticking out of the back of your pants. Like, am I an asshole? Whereas if I just mentioned it on the second floor, like, hey, just so you know, toilet paper, check on your butt. Awkward because it happened immediately, but then if I wait till the 12th floor, you're like, that motherfucker's been looking at my ass in this toilet paper for like, you know, for 13 floors. Like, which is better? Pick. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think you take that like you have someone like, all right, you know, I'm curious what, even if it's not like defined flirting, even it's like, I'm curious what your favorite way to flirt is, and then follow it up with, so would you be receptive if I insert thing that they said here, or like mm-hmm. piece of thing that they said. So like you can kind of follow it up relatively quickly and be like, hey, so what if we started doing that? But I think, I don't know, I was losing where I was going with that.
I was going to say, I love hypotheticals as a flirting thing, because for me as a shy person, they feel very low investment. And sometimes I might say something like, I wonder how you would react if I told you that I think you're super cute. Or like a flirting thing that went really well for me recently was I was on a date and I was like, if it was summertime, I would really want to go make out with you in an alleyway right now. But like, it's really cold outside, so I don't think we can do that. And then that gives the other person an opportunity to either kind of like laugh and move on if they don't want to talk about that further, or they might offer a solution to that problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've brought this blanket and heated parka. Please come into the alleyway. So what about body language? Because this is the other thing I get a lot of pushback on, right? People are mm-hmm. like, oh, and again, like, this is just, I'm just going to say this to your listeners. This is my, all the stuff that's coming out of my mouth is my opinion. Take it or leave mm-hmm. it. But it is my strongly held opinion that if anyone, especially cis guy, says that they are a master at reading body language, tell them Reed Mihalko said suck it, because even if you are a master at reading body language, if you nerd out a little bit on the challenges of navigating this society, this culture these days, any opportunity you can give somebody to use their words is freaking huge. And then for me, as somebody who is a skeptic who loves my peer-reviewed science, and also a mystic, meaning that I've had shit happen to me that I can't find science for yet. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't on drugs when it happened. So as somebody who's also a pragmatist, like if I can believe in all of it, you know, and it's not costing me anything, I'm still a decent human being. What the fuck? Right. Like, I don't need to believe in Wi-Fi to log on to Skype and then to be recording a podcast. Right. I don't even have to understand how Wi-Fi works for that for me to avail myself of it. 300 years ago, it would be miraculous, a miracle to be able to communicate.
Now we're like, it's glitching. God,
yeah, right?
Skype sucks.
So, even for my non-mystics, like, placebo effect is measurable and has been proven. So as long as people are having fun, what the fuck if it's not real or not? Like leverage it. So for me, around body language, even in like woo-woo communities, which I hang out in and teach in, you know, they're like, oh, I can just kind of feel the energy. I'm like, listen, if you're that fucking woo-woo, then you know the power of vibration and the power of speech.
Yeah.
So get people to use their fucking words, because you are doing harm. I guarantee it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So the idea of, with me, it's this tricky place, because I don't want to minimize body language, but for somebody who, you know, when I'm speaking on college campuses, like, I get that there are a lot of social cues, but then it's problematic because people who are on the spectrum can't necessarily read social cues. People, mm-hmm. when, you know, especially when I'm talking to college kids, college adults, you know, after two shots and three beers, you might not be really great at reading social cues and vice versa. Yeah. And we already know people have a problem speaking up and things like that. But I think I get accused of, air quotes, ruining the moment because I keep checking in.
Yeah.
But all I need is somebody to be like, shut the fuck up, Reed. I'll tell you if I want you to stop. And then I'm like,
yeah,
okay. But like, but what's your take on body language? Like, how do you all navigate that?
I have a post about 50 hot ways to ask for consent. And my favorite one on that list that I use all the time is saying, like, I really want to X, like, whatever the thing is, because I think it's like, it's very low pressure. Cause again, like, if the person doesn't want me to do that thing, they can kind of just like move on and like change the subject basically. So I've tried to get good at like, if I want to like touch someone's shoulder or like hold their hand or whatever, but I'm like not sure how they're feeling about it, then I can say like, I really want to do this thing. And it's like, I like it because people think that asking for consent to do that stuff has to be so awkward and clinical and has to be like, would it be okay if I, which is like great too, can be really like earnest and sweet. But I think saying it as a declarative statement is in some ways more confident. And yeah, I really like that. And I would rather that someone say that to me if they were feeling an impulse to touch me, because that gives me the space to decide yes or no. And I find like a lot of dudes who I meet like at bars or like clubs or whatever sometimes will just touch me because they think it's like this pickup artist thing where like if they touch me they'll establish some kind of rapport or connection. And it's like, if you just do that right off the bat, that feels really gross to me. That makes me not want to talk to you more.
Yeah. Well, and again, like so Neil Strauss, who wrote the book The Game, eventually a friend called me up and he's like, you're gonna get a phone call today, I need you to take the call. I'm like, who is it? And they're like, it's Neil Strauss. I'm like, The Game, Neil Strauss? And he's like, this is why I'm calling you. Do a favor to me. Take the call. I'm like, whatever. And I had a conversation, and Neil was working on a new book, and my name had come up a couple of different times about certain things. And so, you know, I spent the weekend with him. He and I eventually became friends, and in his book, The Truth, has a lot of stuff from our conversations in it. And one of those things was this kind of like a lot of the pickup artist stuff, which, you know, in The Game, even though a lot of that stuff's still being taught, was like, this was many years ago now, right? I'm not being an apologist or making excuses. But for a lot of men trying to learn how to, and I'll say specifically with The Game, it tends to be, you know, cis white guys, but not always. But there's a lot of socially awkward men who are like looking for tools to get better with women. And they were getting tools from a lot of men who hadn't examined male privilege or broken down any of this stuff yet. And then what was really, you know, what I really loved about Neil was he was really open about and curious about like, well, like, where did we get it wrong? And I was like, well, here's my list. You know,
let's talk about that.
You know, and those things of like wanting, I mean, Allison, my partner, Allison Moon, author of Girl Sex 101, available at girlsex101.com.
And such one a great of my other book. Favorite sex educators.
Yeah.
But, you know, Allison, when she and I talk about our relationship, the reason, the fastest reason or the quickest pinpoint she can pinpoint to where I could have blown it was I got so excited in meeting, having a conversation about feminism with her that I want to touch her knee because to impress a point. And I stopped and my hand was hovering over her knee. And I was like, I'm very, you know, animated when I talk and I want to make a point and I want to touch your knee, but I didn't ask you if I can touch you yet. So do I have permission to touch your knee to make this point? And Allison, you know, forensically looking back at our relationship, she's like, that, when that happened, something happened in our relationship, because that's where you would have blown it. And so, like, I think a lot of bad, like, there's bad behavior in the evil way of, like, I have learned everything I've learned, and I see where all the flaws are, and I will now leverage them and take advantage of them, and I will be evil. And then there's just, like, clunky behavior, and I'm not being an apologist, but a lot of the conversations I'm having with men these days is about like what I'm calling court awareness, like starting to understand sexism and rape culture and consent culture and gender and racism. Racism's actually investigating that has been really useful in my conversations with white men, because a lot of them can't handle sexual assault and rape culture conversations yet, but some of them can talk about microaggressions and start to wrap their heads mm-hmm. around the dynamics of systemic oppression from the perspective of race.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's not exactly the same, but systemic oppression from a sexuality perspective, when you start looking at it through the lens of male privilege, like there's a lot of useful tools, you know, and I'm not saying there's such a thing as micro assault, but it's been easier for me to get men to start to wake up around the nuances of navigating consent by talking to him a little bit more about race.
I think it's sometimes easier to have those conversations when it's something completely divorced from you, right? Like white men, racism isn't going to encounter them as much as like sexism and stuff does.
Yeah.
And like, I know you're a comic book nerd and I don't want to open this door, but the way X-Men started talking about like oppression of queer folks and everything, and how like that started so many conversations, and everyone, and I always laugh at how like there are so many white men that are like, wow, this completely new concept that they created about how they oppress the mutants. I don't know where they came up with this. And all the queer people in the world are like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, children of the Atom, hearken to my song. Oh, yes. Yes.
But yeah, just kind of something that is like completely separate from them that they can just be like, oh, I understand that. And then you can take those things and be like, and look at how they impact your life. And yeah. Then they're like, oh.
And just this idea of starting to get, you know, men to think about like, you know, who are feeling uncomfortable right now. Like the world is unsafe. They can't trust anyone. I'm like, yes, now you know how women and people of color and folks with disabilities and, you know, queer folk, like now you know how it feels for them pretty much all their life.
Yeah.
So it's an opportunity for empathy and growth. And again, like when it's very rewarding when I can see a guy start to like get it.
Yeah.
But then I'm just telling him like, dude, like this is just the beginning. Like I'm walking around all the time with a low grade, you know, kind of, you know, fear going on, but that's the work. Like,
yeah.
Stick with it, you know, find other men that you can talk to. And again, it's so simple and yet so complex and layered all at the same time. And it comes back to, you know, would it be okay if I told you that I like your hair?
Yeah.
Right. And people are yeah. like, God, that's so clunky. And I'm like, well, here's the deal. Like, let's break it down. So then this brings another question, like, because I feel like I've yeah. got like a little expert
focus group.
I have
body language thoughts before you go okay. jump to that, though.
Okay, go.
Really quick.
Go.
Because I think, so a couple of things with body language. I think it's really easy to become like really obsessed and nerdy with it and be like, I'm reading their mind based on how their pinky twitched. And like, no. But a lot of the discussion around body language is A, to like look for clusters, right? Multiple different signals, not just, you know, maybe their arms are crossed because they are uncomfortable or because they're cold. Like a single one doesn't mean anything. But if their arms are crossed and they're leaning away from you and they're like looking around the room for an exit,
mm-hmm.
they probably don't want to be there.
Yeah.
So like looking for like groups and stuff. And I usually use body language as an indicator for the next consent question I'm going to ask. Right? Like if they're leaning in and I'm getting really positive body language, I might say, hey, can I touch your arm? Hey, can I kiss you? Whatever. But if I'm seeing a lot of body language that they look maybe uncomfortable, or I think there's like a George Carlin skit where he talks about how you're leaning in a 45 degree angle of the direction of which you would like to go.
Yeah.
And like when you see that, that might be a good moment to be like, hey, I'm going to go get a drink. If you want to talk some more, come find me later at the party or whatever. And excuse yourself and put the ball in their court. Because maybe you're reading that body language wrong, but give them the opportunity to kind of make the next step and make the next call for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like, I don't tend to discount it entirely, but I don't use it as like, oh, they're leaning towards me, so I should kiss them. No, they're leaning towards me, so I should ask, can I kiss them?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then also like I'm deaf in my right ear. And so in noisy settings, like I'm like focused on people's faces. Like, I'm looking at your eyes because I'm trying to make sure I'm reading your lips so in case I miss anything. And what ends up happening, people are like, Reed, you're so focused and intent and present. And I'm like, I'm just trying to fucking hear. I can barely hear you right now. But at the same time, like, because I get close. Not like weirdly close, but as an ex-New Yorker, like, we can get pretty close. And again, like, people are like, what do we do now? And I'm like, I'm just trying to hear you. I don't know what are you asking? Like, well, I can't tell. Like, should we kiss? I'm like, I don't know. Do you want to kiss? I like kissing. I mean, if you want to, but I'm just really trying to hear you right now. You're like, and again, like, you don't always know what's going on for the other person.
Yeah.
And then you assume. And when you can catch yourself assuming and stop and then, you know, ask a question or something. I just think it's better to ruin the moment because you spoke up and asked a question than make an assumption and be wrong about that.
And like, okay. So we have a whole episode on how we don't think there is a moment to ruin, but also I kind of like the idea of ruining the moment, because once you ruin the moment once, you're not all sitting there trying to hold the moment together and stressed out. Like, you've addressed, oh, things are weird, and everyone's like, oh, God, things can be weird? Oh, thank God. Okay. Well, and, like, and you have this freedom now.
And also, it's not if you ruin the moment or not, it's can you rebuild the connection? Can you get the car back on the road? Like, we just swerved into the social ditch. Hopefully we didn't, you know, turn over a couple of times, right? But it's like, well, if we can get back on the road, like, we can hey, is everybody good? Like, do we want to keep going in this direction? Like, for me, that's the measure of whether it's safe to move forward. Because again, like, if all you're going to do is say yes to me, if you never say no, I can't actually trust your yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then if we can have something kind of, if we can have a miscommunication, but then find our balance again and re-communicate and get back on track, like, that's a really great sign.
Yeah.
But again, like, not everybody, like, the conversation we're even having about this is actually a pretty high level conversation, like, not to be elitist about things, but there is a certain kind of, like, sexual literacy that is challenging for some, like, for some of the people that I coach, like, once they get really good with their safer sex conversations and asking for what they want, the challenge is they keep finding people that are horrible fits for them. Yeah. And then they complain. They're like, Reed, you know, this is like a certain kind of privilege. You have, like, sexual literacy privilege or whatever, you know, and it's, I don't know, somebody please come up with a better name for it. But but I'm like, well, yeah. And they're like, well, I'm attracted to people who are sexually illiterate, emotionally illiterate. And I'm like, well, I don't know what to tell you, but that's kind of dangerous.
Yeah. Because
you either, that means you're establishing some sort of power dynamic where you are always better than they are, or you're just picking people who can't. What turns you on is that they're bad at communicating, and that just feels dangerous. I don't have answers, easy answers for those situations.
And if, like, you're receiving all of your information about, like, what new relationships can look like and everything from your new partner, that's not necessarily a healthy dynamic either, right? If they're the one teaching you, no, relationships are like this all the time, like, they need more points of view, right? So that they can establish their own knowledge.
I have met a couple of people. Like, generally speaking, I would counsel that people don't date the newbie all the time, right? For the reasons you just said. However, I have met a couple of people that are very healthily kind of the like the poly Sherpas and midwives and doulas of the world, right? Where they enjoy, you know, showing somebody a whole new world, but for them, where it's really healthy is it's kind of a catch and release program. You know, they expect the person to outgrow them, because what are the odds that I'm actually your species on your first try? Right, like, they've reconciled that, and so they're not trying to, like, create some weird power dynamic where they entrap somebody. But they really do. It's just like, it's their joy. Like, it's kind of, here's my bad analogy. It's like they're a music teacher who enjoys teaching somebody how to play guitar, but never expects them to actually start a band with them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
You know, they expect you to learn guitar and then go start your own band. And they just love that they got to show you the open up the world of music to you.
Yeah.
I don't know if that analogy works, but that's what I got.
No, I gotcha. So kind of speaking of body language, I wanted to ask you about this theory of yours. I can't even remember where I stumbled across this. I think it was a video about kissing, but you have this theory about a wine glass. And when I heard you explain it, I was like, fuck, that's brilliant. And I wanted to apply it to like everything in my life. Can you tell us about your wine glass theory? Okay.
Remind me to get you the link to that video, because you can just drop it into the show notes.
Okay.
But so again, like we talked about, you know, me being a mystic, I play a lot with and teach a lot about what I call energetic sex. And it's playing with erotic energy, whether you believe in it or not. That's not the point, is whether people are having fun or not. And for me, as somebody who's had what I would call a Kundalini awakening, again, my scientists, keep listening. I'm not offending you.
There's a body story where you told that we can put in the show notes, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the easiest way to help people to start figuring out how to play with energy, air quotes, energy, or what would just be like nuanced sensation in a world where most people are just like, you know, put a condom on and just let me bang the hell out of you, right? So if you start slowing things down and really trying to, like, what's the most information or experience you can experience with the least amount of stimulation, now we start getting, like, it's like we're going smaller and smaller through the microscope, and we're seeing smaller and smaller particles, and then there's that little like walrus creature that lives everywhere, whatever that's called. I used to have the word, and that would occur really smart if I could remember it. They're the tiny, tiny ones.
It's a small risk.
Yeah, but they're indestructible, and somebody tweet that word out. They're cute as hell, but they're tiny, tiny macroscopic things. And we keep getting smaller and smaller. Now we're into the realm of like nuanced energetic sex and eroticism, and maybe it's all placebo effect, but who the fuck cares? The wine glass analogy is the easiest way to get people in the right headspace to play with nuance. So if for those of you who've ever tried to make a wine glass sing, and if you haven't, then you know, the video will help. But most people, when you ask them to try to make a wine glass sing, like you ask them, what are you trying to do, right? So I will ask you to. We'll do it as an exercise. Like, when you're trying to make a wine glass sing, what is it that you're trying to do?
You have to balance the amount of pressure and moisture on the edge, right?
Yeah.
And, like, it's a lot of precision.
Okay.
And the right speed, I think.
Great. So you just named it, right? There's three basic things. It's speed or rate, like frequency. How frequently do you complete a circle or a loop on the glass? Then there's pressure. Is it too much pressure? Is it not enough pressure? And then is it too wet or is it too dry? And those combination of things, if you can hit the sweet spot, you'll get the wine glass to start resonating, to start vibrating, and it'll make that like, ooh, like sound that it will make. What most people don't understand is when they're doing that, they're shifting and changing in really small ways all three of those dynamics, searching for that sweet spot. And where they go with their attention and their intention to find that sweet spot is kind of a particular place. It's different for everybody, but the idea is you shift to some place to be able to figure out if you're moving closer to make the wine glass sing or further away from making it sing. And mostly you're doing that all at the same time, and you're not conscious of all the shifts and the nuances. So for people, when you're listening to us right now on the podcast, your attention and intention is, you know, you're picking up sound through your ears, and you're kind of sitting there being like, huh, well, what about that? He just said that thing, and Kate just said that brilliant thing. What do I think about that? And Beck said that thing, and what do I think about that? Huh? And all that's going on. Well, if we handed you a wine glass and said, try to make it sing, wherever all of your attention shifts to, when you start doing that physical activity, let's call that your wine glass place. Mm-hmm. For some people, they're very much in their fingers and the wine glass, and they're touching the wine glass, and they're like listening with their fingers. For other people, they're like, you know, I'm listening with my heart, and I'm touching the universe. For other people, it's like, I'm just fucking looking at the wine glass with my finger swelling around it, like that dog meme that says, I don't know what I'm doing. I have no clue what I'm doing. Somebody else is like looking at the wine glass with soft focus versus a sharp focus. Like, everyone goes to a different place. Some people are like listening with their guts. Wherever that place is for you, that's your wine glass place, and that is going to be yours. Just because I, Reed Mihalko, go in between my ears and kind of listen for a feeling that's about 3 inches in between my ears, that's just where I go. And there's a certain feeling or sound in between my ears that feels like I'm moving closer to making it sing. And then sometimes when I move in the right direction, it will start to hum. You can apply this to playing with people's bodies, whether it's energetic or just making out with their vulva, right? And this is like, or giving a blowjob or a handjob or making out. Like, bad kissers, when you talk to people about bad kissers, almost unanimously people will agree it feels like they can't hear my body. They're not listening to my face. They are just kissing me without, they're tone deaf to kissing, basically. So, you know, when I teach the wine glass piece in some of my sex classes and in energetic sex classes, it's like, just try it. Like, the next time you make out with somebody, the next time you, you know, go down on somebody, try going to your wine glass place and try to feel or listen or hear or sense. Are you creating more pleasure, or are you moving further away and creating less pleasure? And that is the wine glass analogy.
God, I love that. It's so brilliant, and it gives me chills. I love it.
Cool. It makes me excited that people like it. Like, because again, like, I mean, I've had the pleasure and the privilege of coming up with a lot of useful stuff. That analogy, and I've never heard of it or read of it anywhere else. It could be that somebody else figured it out, and I just never came across it. And if somebody does have evidence, like, I would love to attribute it properly. Even if I came up with it all myself, if somebody else came up with it a long time ago, like, let's, attribution is powerful. But the that might be the simplest, most powerful bit of advice for creating better sex and how to learn how to listen to other human beings' bodies.
Oh, it's so good. Thank you, Reed. Thank you so much for being on our show. I have wanted to have you on our show forever because you're one of my favorite sex educators. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Can you plug all your stuff and tell our listeners where they can find you?
The kind of headquarters for everything is readaboutsex.com, readaboutsex.com. And from there, you can just go down the rabbit hole of all kinds of stuff. If you're if you want to get better at relationships and communication, then go to relationship10xonline.com. And if you want to get better at sexuality skill sets and self-confidence around sex, then sex10x, the number 10xonline.com. Those are two online courses that I have. And then for sex educators or sex-positive professionals and entrepreneurs who want to nerd out with other sex-positive professionals, Sex Geek Summer Camp is my 5-day business retreat. It's an actual sleepaway summer camp, and you will. It's a lot of fun. People are getting a lot out of it. I try to make it as affordably accessible as possible. Camp doesn't make a lot of money, but it's a ton of fun, and it's an excuse for me to wear shorts from the 80s and a whistle. And knee socks. So it's totally cheese dick, but it's helping a lot of us just have more powerful conversations as educators around different business models.
And I've been meaning to go for so long, but it's always you put it right near Woodhull, which is amazing. Okay,
but it's not near Woodhull this year.
That many days off.
Here's the thing. Okay, so this is our 5th anniversary for camp. It's in Portland, Oregon this year, which doesn't help everybody, right? but this is our first year on the West Coast, and we're 2 weeks or 3 weeks before Woodhull. because I wanted to give people enough time to be able to get to Woodhull if they want to double dip. So again, just go to sexgeeksummercamp.com. You can sign up for some free training videos. And if somebody wants to register for camp immediately, then go to readaboutsex.com/camp FAQ. That's the short link to bypass all the videos and just go right to the, like, I want to sign up and I want information about how to get there and all that stuff. So there, excellent. That's it.
Cool. Thank you. I have been Kate Sloan. You can find my sex blog at girlyjuice.net and the rest of my writing at katewritesaboutsex.com. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at girly_juice. Where is your stuff, Bex?
I'm Bex. You can find all my writing at bextalksex.com. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at bextalksex. Together, we're the Dildorks. We're at the Dildorks on Twitter and Instagram and at thedildorks.com. You can also find us by searching the Dildorks in your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, rate and review us. It makes us easier for other sex geeks to find.
Thank you to Protodome, who did our theme song, I Want You in My Bedroom. And thank you to Amy, who did our logo. She is at starboots_ on Twitter. And thank you to you for listening. Until next time, folks, get out there and live your sexy, dorky life. Bye.
And I'm so nervous I'm going to say some boneheaded cis white guy thing. And then
we'll edit it out. It's
that's what we have editing for.
Yeah. So, hey, what's up? How you doing?
Hey. That's right. Hey. We'll gently poke you if you say a stupid white dude thing and then just edit it out.
Can you just find it? Yeah. Smitten Kitten brought me in to do an in-service training on prostate massage. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to Jennifer, I'm like, can they just stick their fingers up my butt? Like, can we just do that? It's just, it'll be the easiest way for me to teach them. And Jennifer's like, you're cool with that? I'm like, yeah.
I have one of those. It's just easier. I'll just show it to you.
I mean, I can teach all the things, but like, and again, it's not mandatory, but if it's not creepy for your staff, like they might as well stick their fingers up my butt and then feel my prostate. Cause duh. And it'll make for a great story. No, it was great. It was a really fun class. I love teaching show and tell stuff when it's appropriate.
Yeah.
No, show and tell stuff is it can be tricky when done wrong. But if you can safeport your audience, it works really well and it's super powerful. Because you're just, I mean, we're all nerds, right? We're like, hey, you know, how do you do that thing with your dildo? And you're like, well, here, let me show you. Drop your trowel. We think that that's normal. But, like, for muggles, it's like, what?